feedback last night, and believe it or not, again today, that I want to go ahead and address just right up front. So it's not a typo here. I did not intend to have Thornhill below Joshua here, but only Joshua Thornhill thought I did. But we're not talking about how to lead like Josh Thornhill. That's just so everybody knows. Yeah, just so everybody knows. But anyway, so go ahead and be opening your Bibles up to the book of Joshua. We started talking yesterday about leadership, and we've framed it around the book of Joshua, the story of Joshua. And we're calling the series "Dare to Lead Like Joshua." And just a quick kind of reset from yesterday, the things we talked about is that leadership lessons applies to everyone. And hope I've convinced you of that yesterday. Whether you're serving in a formal or what we might call positional leadership situation. Or if your leadership that you provide now is mostly informal, it's just simply your example or your influence. Everyone influences someone else, so everyone is a leader in that sense. And even if I can't sell you with either one of those, remember leadership lessons apply to followers as well. They help us learn, hopefully if we're aspiring to one day be a leader in our own mind, or will make us better followers when we know what to expect from leaders, or we have a better understanding of what it is leaders are dealing with or how they approach their job. So leadership lessons for everyone. Yesterday we talked about just dare to be a leader. We began with Joshua's commission there at the very beginning of this letter. Their important part of that we stress was now, therefore, arise. And in a sense, you know, it was clear to us that Joshua had been the heir apparent. He had been Moses' assistant, but now it was his time. And God says to him, now, therefore, arise. And what we tried to stress yesterday was God needs men to step up. God needs men that will be leaders. They need to be in their homes and in our churches. And we talked about the job description, how ultimately the leader's job description is to be strong and be courageous. And I hope we were able to bring to mind instances and examples of when that's necessary for leaders to do and to be. We talked about the importance of making assessment, how leaders need to be, you know, Joshua sent in spies to get the recon pass before they cross the river. Leaders need to be looking around, being observant, understand the situation, always soliciting input. Being open to feedback, building trust is what we talked about between the leader and whatever unit or organization that is that the leader is leading, and then moving out on faith. Immediately, you leverage that trust. You're asking people to trust you to accomplish something. So we trust in God, and then we encourage those we're leading because everything we're doing is about our trust in God or response to that. We're encouraging people really to consecrate themselves, just like Joshua did the people before they crossed the river. And we talked about the idea of being consecrated implies being holy and being ready. Being holy and being ready to prove yourself set apart, to step out on faith and accomplish what it is God would have us accomplish. And the last thing we kind of talked about yesterday was preparing for success. And now as a leader, what that means sometimes is overcoming inertia. So leading a group of people to put away some things they've been used to doing that aren't beneficial, or beginning to do some things that we haven't been doing that we should be doing. So, but inertia is a very powerful driver in human behavior, and that has to be overcome sometimes. And we characterized or we pictured a leader as we finished yesterday, that episode of Joshua kneeling with sword in hand. Because a leader of God's people has always to be ready to protect God's people, but also always seeking God's guidance. So that's the things that we talked about yesterday. And today, in lesson two, we'll talk about daring to fight battles. Because ultimately, leadership involves leading through challenges, right? And leadership is most important in challenging environments and in challenging circumstances. So wartime leadership, in a sense, in the spiritual warfare that we're engaged in, we'll talk today about leading through challenges or leading through battles. So begin with me in Joshua chapter 6, in a section, just call this Executing God's Plan. And I think it's obviously a story from Scripture you're quite familiar with, the fall of Jericho. And when you think about the fall of Jericho, and from what you already know about it, we'll do a quick reminder here. Just remember the connection we yesterday said, part of leadership is getting people ready to move out on faith. Let me suggest to you, that comes up very quickly would you consider the battle plan for taking Jericho? So if you would, read with me Joshua chapter 6, and let's read the first five verses. Now Jericho was shut up inside and outside because of the people of Israel. None went out, none came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city, all the men of war, going around the city once. Thus shall you do for 6 days. Seven priests shall bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. On the seventh day you shall march around the city seven times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up, everyone straight before him." Now, as you read that, if you're a general leading an army, and your objective is a walled city, and you call together your top commanders for a planning conference, and they say, "Okay, boss, how are we going to do this? How are we going to take this walled city?" So, guys, I got an idea. I think we're going to march around it one time a day, not say anything, but on that seventh day. I mean, so anyway, you get the point here. If you gathered any of the greatest military strategists in the world on the taking of walled cities in ancient times and had them submit plans, nobody would come up with this one, would they? Not the way I'd have done it. And let me tell you, that's some of the feedback you always get as a leader, is when you announce the way we're going to do it, the plan of attack, how we're going to handle this situation, not the way I would have done it, is one you hear quite regularly. But see, in this instance, that's exactly the case. There's nothing about this plan to take a walled city that relies on human ability or human ingenuity or even the way men would have thought to have done it. It's God's plan, and it will require moving out on faith to execute God's plan. It's what you would call a non-traditional strategy. And the point at this juncture is not to think about maybe the way we go about programmatically solving problems like construction projects or buying pews versus chairs and those kind of things. But I want you to elevate thinking right now to think about some of the things we lead people to do as leaders in the church or as leaders in our homes in our service to God are, from a worldly perspective, non-traditional strategies. We're asking people to do things that their neighbors aren't willing to do. We're asking people to live lives that most folks around them are not willing to live. But you do it because God has called you to do it. You do it because it's God's plan, whether it's for the home like we're talking about this week or whatever else. There's the way God wants it done, the way everybody else does it, and we're devoted to doing it God's way. And the feedback when you do that is always from some, "Not the way I would have done it." But you have to lead through that because ultimately everything we're talking about reflects our devotion to God. So let's think about things that we do that maybe human wisdom might not be the way we'd have done it even or thought about it. Baptism. Maybe one of the biggest obstacles we have when we try to teach people is what the Bible teaches about baptism. And maybe they think, what can being dipped in H2O have to do with anything? Well, maybe it's not what you would have thought of or what you would have come up with, but we're dedicated to teaching what God teaches about it, what God teaches on that matter. And that's one most of us are firmly rooted in, don't have a problem with. But you will see issues like that where things are just us humbly accepting what God has said on a subject, whether it is the organization, the work and worship of the church, the temptation to come up with other organizations or institutions to do things more efficiently than the church can get them done. There are things that make sense to people, and people will think, "Well, that sounds good to me." That's not the same as saying this is the way God has shown us to do it. And our commitment is to lead that way, to carry out God's plan. Marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Now I'm thinking about from an elder's perspective and leading in a local church and being responsible for the feeding of that flock and the things that the folks that are there are going to hear, the teaching that you're going to require or demand, the preaching you're going to require or demand, and the things you want people to think about. The pushback is going to be, "Well, I don't know about that," or "I'm not sure that sounds fair. I'm not sure that sounds loving." But this is what God has revealed to us about some of these things. Let me suggest this to you. Just the notion that church leadership is structured the way it is, and it's not a democracy. That is a challenge in America, particularly, right? So there are all kind of things that aren't the way some people would have done it, but are the way God has done it. And leadership involves helping people execute God's plan. And you think about, what do you think might be on the horizon? We'll have challenges to the way God's plan is written and what people might expect or want or desire or push for.
The necessity for assembling the saints now that we have the digital options.
Yeah, you saw, and it's amazing how so many recent leadership lessons go back to some decisions that were made maybe during COVID. But now that the cat is out of the bag, proverbially, or the virtual cat's out of the virtual bag, I guess, people that would not have argued you could virtually assemble 4 years ago now will think you can virtually assemble. And that'll have to be dealt with. Let me suggest to you women's roles. There are going to be more and more questions about that. Well, exactly what are the limits? And you're going to be challenged between principle and practice. And is this passage about in the assembly or not in the assembly? And those kind of things. Those are the things I'm talking about that are coming that will be out of step with the culture and the time we're living in. I mean, the culture and time in which you're flock and your family, your children are living in, and we have to be dedicated to just carrying out God's plan on that. Because here is what leaders of God's people fundamentally have to believe and be dedicated to. God's plan will work if we will just work God's plan. And so you have to be thinking about that. That has to be a mantra that is the way you approach whatever next year, next week, next month's in vogue new thing is. No, here we're dedicated to doing things God's way. And you have to own that personally. You have to own that for your family. You have to be dedicated to that in leading a congregation of the Lord's people. It may not be the way I'd have done it, but it's the way God has said do it, and that's how we're going to do it. Yes, sir.
Bottom line, or are you casting doubt when you say that might not be the way I would do it?
I would say that's situational, but as long as you always got to come back to the nevertheless, thy will be done. It may be in a certain situation, maybe not publicly, maybe privately, you can make a concession. Look, I see this as hard. I mean, I have a lot of times with young people where I have that simple that conversation that you need to have with young people is, hey, this is where you learn the difference between simple and easy. Right, because you're telling me it's going to be hard for you to do what God said, but you got to agree with me what God said is simple to understand. And those are just different things. So I think sometimes it ends up coming down helping people understand the difference between simple and easy.
You know, J.R. made the statement, I forget who he was quoting, but somebody actually made the statement, there are questions that I cannot answer, but there are also answers that I cannot question.
And that's a good thought, because ultimately, however we end up communicating it, in a way, obviously we don't want to dishonor God or anything he's credited to us, but at the end of the day, we understand enough to know what God requires of us, and we're committed to doing that. And that will be something that, obviously, Project 1A on Joshua's list when he became leader was an instance like that. You just have to move out on faith. You have to execute God's plan. Listen, maybe the place where this comes up the most, where people say, well, we don't... Listen, I know of local churches where the leadership there has decided, well, we don't do church discipline. Why not? Well, it doesn't work. Work God's plan, and God's plan will work. That's the point I'm trying to make. Yes, sir. Yeah.
It's just like the thing that we were talking about the other day with Abraham sort of messing up.
Thinking he was helping.
Yeah. God. In reality, God's got something bigger than that. And we need to recognize that. We don't have all the facts.
That's a great point. And let me, everybody here that's younger than me, which is most of you now, I hate that. If you haven't figured this out already, go ahead and figure this out. If you're in a congregation that has elders... By necessity, they know things you don't know. So if you need one more little argument to help you understand, to give those men the benefit of the doubt and to give them grace as they make decisions, just go to pillow your head tonight and you can, I guarantee you this is true, those men know things you don't know. They know things you don't need to know and know things they can't tell you, and because of commitments they've made to other people and respect they have for other people, they don't need to tell you. But if it ever helps calm you down a little bit, just be assured that your leaders know things you don't know, and let that be helpful to you. Yes, sir. Certainly. Reports.
We would like for you to tell us about the problems that come up in the church. And they're going to send that out to the whole congregation.
Yeah.
You know, are you elders going to tell all the churches are going to come bowing?
The problems you're having.
The problems that are in the church. So if you're supporting guys, realize they can't make certain things public.
That's right. And this is just me standing here flat-footed now. See, when you say that out loud, what I just heard was those that either you need our help with or germane to us. But when I hear somebody say, tell me your problems, I think what they really mean is those that they can help you with or those that affect or impact them. I'm assuming that's what they meant. And the rest of them I'd probably just keep private and local is how I'd probably think. Yeah, that's probably what I would assume they meant by that. But we're executing God's plan. And we're trying to motivate a bunch of other people to execute God's plan. And that's what our commitment is. And then I threw this one back in because it's needed. Leaders lead. And you see that manifested again several ways. And maybe the way here and the reason I brought it up again is because leaders command. So start reading with me in verse 6. Chapter 6 and verse 6. So here's Joshua's faith. He got this plan, and he doesn't negotiate with God. He got this plan, and here's where he starts moving out. Verse 6, so Joshua the son of Nun called the priests and said to them, take up the Ark of the Covenant, let seven priests bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord. And he said to the people, go forward, march around the city, let the armed men pass on before the Ark of the Lord. And just as Joshua had commanded the people, the seven priests bearing the trumpets of the horns before the Lord went forward, blowing the trumpets with the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord following them, the armed men were walking before the priests who were blowing the trumpets, and the rear guard was walking after the Ark while the trumpets blew continually. But Joshua commanded the people, you shall not shout nor make your voice heard, neither shall any word go out of your mouth until the day I tell you to shout, then you shall shout. And the only point there is to see that Joshua as a leader commanded. He led. He instructed. He gave guidance in a very clear way, very detailed way. We talked about importance of communication yesterday. But he got the instruction out there, got the word out, got the people instructed. And I love, this is a lesson in and of itself. A lot of times I'm reading a passage and I'll say, now this isn't the main point, but this is a point. How many times in the Bible is it a point that you have the command in one verse, and then you have almost, you could cut and paste the language of the command, and the obedience to that command is the same exact language is used here. So I think you see that, and it already tells you somewhat about the trust the people had in him. But I'm going to foot stomp this one more time, then we'll move on. Leaders have to lead. And we live in a culture that doesn't recognize leadership because it's not well practiced and people aren't used to it because they're Americans and they got their rights. But let me just suggest to you, as far as this leadership conversation goes, like we said in point one, the Lord set it up to where the church is not a democracy. Now, use all the tips we just learned in the last hour about the way you communicate, and you want to do everything you do as a servant leader for people to at least know your motive for anything you're communicating is the overall spiritual growth and good of the group. But then the time comes when something has to be done or decision has to be made, you have to act on that authority. And again, Americans struggle with this. And what I would suggest to you, that's just something that's in our DNA. And so you talk about, there are things that, like I think Stephen, the example you used this morning is important. In the family, in the home, we need to push back through the 1950s. Let me suggest to you about this idea about leadership and submission. We got to push all the way back through 1776, okay? We have some things that are inherently American that are not inherently biblical. And those are obstacles we need to recognize in ourselves, overcome ourselves, and have other people overcome them. So that's why every time this comes up, I underline it and I bring it to your attention. Yes, sir.
I don't know if this is stretching it or not from the text, but I've heard some criticism
it's noteworthy, at least to me, to see what God told Joshua about when to shout. And then Joshua doesn't just say exactly that. He says that, but he says don't say anything until then shout. And so I think a lot of times what I've heard, at least in some comments on things, some criticism, is that we've established this hermeneutic of be silent, of the Bible silent, and speak the Bible speaks, and things like that. But that's actually how these guys invented it.
Yeah. And I think it's always good to catch those times in Scripture. You just see what we're talking about is just how communication happens, and that absolutely is not a hermeneutic. It's just how information is passed, and just how instruction is given, and just how communication happens. And I think again, that's one of those points where this ain't the main point, but boy, that's a point that's made here, isn't it? I think that's a good catch. But let me suggest this to you, it's not that leaders are command because we want to, throw our chest out and because we're self-important. That's not it. And I hope nothing I say comes across in that manner. It's all about getting a group of God's people, encouraging them to honor and glorify God by accomplishing His will. And if you think otherwise, maybe this will help a little bit. Because I say there's the light falls back on the leaders to be leaders. They've got to be leaders that leaders have to get up and show up. So this, I know this will hurt some of you. I've just got two boys who just graduated college. The ability to sleep 16 hours in a row is impressive to me, because I cannot remember that. I don't know which is more impressive, the fact my sons can sleep for 16 hours or drink a gallon of milk in a half a day. I don't know which one it is, but I've outgrown both of those. But let's do this. As the story goes on there, they're making preparations to execute this in this section here, but let's look at verse 12 with me. Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priest took up the ark of the Lord. One of those verses you'd just keep going if you weren't reading this book through the leadership lens. Something very important was going to happen for the people that needed to start very early the next morning. Where does the leader need to be? Up and early, up with them. Listen, you can't lead anybody from the bedroom, all right? So sometimes leaders, we have to be on scene. Right, particularly if you're asking people, you've said this probably about people that think, well, that's being a Christian sounds like that's too hard. And maybe you've said this: the Lord's not asking anything of you He wasn't willing to do Himself. You think about His willingness to suffer and the things that He went through. Well, a good leader doesn't ask anything of people they're not willing to do themselves. And so sometimes a leader has to get up. And a leader has to show up. I don't care how insignificant the thing may seem. There's nothing that's beneath a real leader. There's a workday scheduled at the building. If a bathroom needs to be cleaned, I'll clean the bathroom if that's what needs to be done. There's nothing that is beneath a real leader. Because it's not about us. It's about maybe it'll help that young guy see, well, hey, if that old guy over there thinks that's important enough for his time, it's got to be important enough for mine. So maybe you're teaching someone else about those sort of things. Now, you could counter with the idea of the apostles thought it wasn't meat for them, but I'm not going to counter that argument about this one here. When we get together as a local church to do things, nothing is beneath a leader that needs to be done, and you need to be a servant leader and be willing to get up and show up. Don't come up with tasks that are for the others to accomplish. And it may be now you're thinking of maybe you've served under leaders that seem to be their attitude. Maybe in church or maybe not in church, but have you ever had a boss where it seemed like the rules applied to me but not to thee? How do you feel about a leader like that? Yeah, it just doesn't work out. Now, there are times and places where there's certain things only the leader could be taking care of at this time, and I can find another way to serve. But if they know who you are, they know that's the only reason you're out there with them, because you're taking care of something they can't take care of. But as far as who you are on any given day, is you need to be the kind of person that's humble enough. There's not a single task that's beneath you because you're the leader. And there'd be anything that Dad's too good to do around the house if it needs to be done. Listen, I come from a line of men. My grandfather had 8 children and 26 grandchildren, and he went to his grave with 0 diapers in his tally sheet. Never changed a diaper in his whole life. I mean, y'all could stand and applaud if you want to. But times have just changed, right? So what you learn, what life will teach you is, as a servant leader, there's times and places where nothing needs to be beneath you. You need to get up and you need to show up. The point is, we can't always delegate. And while you can delegate tasks, you can't delegate that job you have to give the vision, to motivate, and to help people accomplish that thing. That's something that they need to look and see you there if you're their leader, if you want to get the best out of them. So you got to, leaders have to be visible. Leaders have to be willing to participate in whatever it is they have the group doing. You got to be out in the trenches sometimes, right? And I will tell you, it's a trap that's easy to fall into, is this idea of the ivory tower leadership, right? Yeah, you've seen that in work, maybe. And I think sometimes in some churches, elders can become detached from the flock. And I would take other people's experience or thought of this. I will tell you something that we had to be kind of intentional. And the other men I serve with, and I would tell you this, I wasn't an elder during COVID, but the rhythm changed so much. They were meeting so often in their office, and the only way they could communicate with the rest of us was via email or something like that. It took them a while to relearn the rhythm once we got back to actually being face-to-face and that sort of thing. So you got to always, I think, be mindful of that. If you get out of sync, you don't want to be an eldership that only communicates via fiat, you know, just through written statement. You put these two ideas together, and that's something I really tried to help nudge our eldership back towards, is they kind of got in a rut, and I'll tell on them, love those men, and happy to be serving with them, but we've talked about this, is without thinking about it, if you're not careful, you can get in a rut where the congregation only sees you when you're about to read a prepared statement, and then you finish reading and you sit back down. And so we've talked not there's anything inherently wrong with that. And sometimes some information you need to communicate, you need to pause, make sure you say exactly what you want to say, and then quit. But we have a rule now where, hey, it can't be the only thing the congregation hears when you stand up is the reading of a prepared statement. You need to at least engage them conversationally, tell them why you're going to say what you're about to say. If part of it has to be read, read it, and then fold that piece of paper up and look them in the eye and talk to them. So as a leader, sometimes particularly as a representative of a group of people, you feel a little bit hesitant to be very outspoken because you want people to think you're the elder, the head elder. It's okay to use a pronoun like we, because you're talking for the other group and you've been empowered. But there's an important difference between talking with people and talking at people. And a communication, guys, runs through every tenet, every facet of leadership. It's about communication. So when you need to have a family conference, you typically don't prepare notes, do you? So that's what I've encouraged us as a group of elders to think about. If we decide on Saturday there's something this group really needs to hear tomorrow, let's write it down if we need to make sure what we want to say, and then whoever's going to present it, go home, think about it, remember what it is. Try your best to be able to just say it conversationally. If you need to refer to a piece of paper, do that, but you open with a personal communication with the people, convey the information. If there's some statistics or something you don't want to memorize, reading it's fine. But then fold up a piece of paper, look people in the eye, and talk to them, talk with them again. So communication is very important. You cannot rule from afar. And I would tell you the other thing that this creates. So you showing up and you being there when you have people doing something, whether it's, if you know there's going to be if I know there's going to be a bunch of young moms there cutting out stuff or getting ready for VBS on a Saturday morning, I'm going to walk through the building. You know, I know I'm a supported preacher, so I got more time to do that sort of thing. I get that. But those are the kind of things that if people are doing something, be there, be visible. That's where you build your credibility. That's where you have opportunity to have some of those conversations that aren't happening from behind the pulpit to build your relationships with people. That's how they know you care about the effort they're making to teach their children, the other children in the congregation, because you're there helping them if they need it or talking to them about it, or at least you see what they're doing. So that comes into credibility. Let me suggest this to you from our little story here. It takes some amount of credibility with your followers to call your people in and say, let me brief you on the battle plan. And it's what Joshua had to share with them. You got to have some credibility with your captains to explain to them, we're going to march around it and play horns. Any questions? That's how we're going to take this walled city. So it takes a lot of credibility, a stored up capital, leadership capital, to talk like he has to in verses 16 through 19 to tell them things, but it takes a lot in order to get the response he gets in verse 20. So the people shouted, and the trumpets were blown. As soon as they heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted a great shout, and the wall fell down flat so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they captured the city. The point is, Joshua, he'd been out there, camped out all night with them, got up early, started the process. They trusted him. They trusted God's plan, and they executed it just as it was commanded. They did exactly what they were asked to do. But that's the result of leaders that will get up and leaders that will show up. Any thoughts, questions, or comments on that idea? The first one's getting easier for me because you get to be my age. As soon as I get the first light leak in the morning, I'm awake on the floor. But I would suggest to you, maybe for younger guys, and I have this conversation like with my sons. Like, hey, hope you enjoyed college. You're in the real world now. And nobody wants to hear about you sleeping until 11:30. At least not guys my age, that their opinion of you might matter to you in the next few years. So if you see that in your horizon as if a habit you haven't dropped yet, if it comes a time to put away childish things, so it might be something you would think about as being somebody that folks can kind of, well, we're not going to see him till 11:30. You don't want to be that guy. So leaders get up, leaders show up, and leaders follow up. And slides freeze up. Okay, well, let me go back one. Leaders follow up. Let's read beginning of verse 22. But the two men who had spied out the land, Joshua said, go into the prostitute's house, bring out there the woman who and all who belonged to her as you swore to her. So the young men went who had been spies and went in and brought out Rahab and her father and her mother and her brothers and all who belonged to her. And they brought out all her relatives and brought them outside the camp of Israel. And they burned the city with fire and everything in it, only the silver and gold, the vessels, the bronze, the iron. They put the treasury to the house of the Lord. But Rahab the prostitute and her father's household and all who belonged to her, Joshua saved alive. And she was saved in Israel to this day because she hid the messengers who Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. And Joshua laid an oath on them at that time, saying, cursed before the Lord be the man who rises up and rebuilds this city Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn shall he lay the foundation, and the cost of his youngest son shall he set up its gates. So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. And so what I'm suggesting, what you see here is Joshua following up. And leaders have to follow up. And this is a place leaders stumble sometimes. It's so easy when you cross that finish line and accomplish that thing to want to move on to the next thing. Follow-up takes discipline. The military parallel to this is the debrief, right? So before we go on a mission, we're very careful about making sure everything's ready, about getting together, about briefing what we're going to do. But once you land, you're kind of, we're done, let's go home. But the secret is, no. The U.S. taxpayer just spent a lot of money for you guys to do that training exercise. You need to get in a room somewhere and get all the value you possibly can out of it. You need to do the debrief. You need to talk about it and get all the lessons learned. Follow-up is absolutely critical, and follow-up is critical for leaders. But notice here what Joshua did. These things, three things you see in that little paragraph we just read. First, he remembered. And when a leader makes a commitment, they have to remember it. They have to own up to it. They have to follow through with it. The promise to Rahab and her household, right? Right here, Joshua recalls that. He had a commitment, and sometimes I will tell you, as leadership, it's hard to, we struggle with record-keeping. But you got to inject some discipline into some processes. You got to write down decisions you've made or conversations you've had or promises and things that have been made. So you got to be able to track your commitments, whether that means, every time I say, hey, Marlene, will you remind me of that? She'll say, hey, what's that thing in your hand? And I'm learning that I can put reminders on this thing. And it's just amazing to, somebody's talking about technology. Well, let's get the good we can out of it. It takes no time whatsoever. Hey, follow up with Dan Morse about that conversation we had. Or, hey, I know Sam's child's been sick. I need to check with him on Tuesday about that sort of thing. Or I had a conversation. So just whatever it takes out there, leaders follow up. And people like to be followed up with. It lets them know that you do care about them. And you do it because you care about them. Accountability shows up again. He had made a promise. He had those spies had told Rahab what they were going to do, and he was going to make sure that happened. So leaders keep their word. Leaders enforce accountability, but leaders demonstrate accountability. You hold others accountable. Leaders hold themselves accountable. You ever work for somebody who held everybody accountable but themselves? Anybody else been in that situation? That's very frustrating. And you can't accomplish some of the other things we've talked about if that's how your followers feel about you. So you got to hold yourself accountable. Yes, sir.
He was accountable even though he didn't make the promise.
That's right. But he had the authority or the responsibility to make sure it happened, didn't he? Joshua understood the alignment of accountability and responsibility. So hold others accountable. Allow others to hold you accountable. You cannot be a leader who won't accept feedback, who won't accept even critical feedback if it's warranted. And listen, brethren are masters at hiding criticism as, I've got a suggestion. You know, we have all kind of euphemisms. We have all kind of euphemisms for criticism, but you have to be willing to take that. If you're willing to, part of that calculus that says, I'm willing to step up, includes you know you're going to get feedback, both solicited and unsolicited, both valuable and feedback that's not that valuable, but you signed up for that. So, you know, you have to be willing to accept that. You have to let others hold you accountable if you're going to hold them accountable. And then the last one of those three is reliability. Everybody now knows Joshua will do what he says he's going to do. Joshua will keep his commitments, keep his promises, and leaders have to do that. We have to be people that will do what we say, mean what we say, say what we mean, and people can count on our word that we're going to follow through. And if we can't, then we explain. That's another thing I think leaders struggle with sometimes is a hesitancy to say, hey, sorry, we couldn't make that happen. We owe you just as much to explain to you why we didn't do something we say we're going to do. Sometimes we think, well, we weren't able to accomplish that. Well, let's be quiet. Maybe nobody will notice. That's not a good approach. Somebody's going to notice. But the other thing it does, it again builds that trust. You're willing to say, hey, listen, we had a plan. We didn't get it done on time. Here's an update. Here's what we're going to do next. Because you know what? You're human. And you don't control everything. And sometimes things don't happen. There's unforeseen things that pop up. But transparency, when you're capable of that, communication, you don't want to not say something that a possible outtake from that was, oh, they're not reliable. No, I'm reliable. I'm reliable enough to come tell you why I didn't get done what I said I was going to get done. So be honest, be transparent, communicate. Leaders follow up. Any thoughts on anything on that slide that we've talked about from that section? Well, so now you're thinking, man, leadership is great. But let me tell you, every battle is not Jericho, right? You read just the battle reports from Jericho, you think, that's leadership. There's nothing to this. You just march around, blow a few horns, things go well, right? So every battle is not Jericho. If you always had cooperative troops and you always have an easy victory, then leadership would be easy. And everybody would be willing to step up, but not all battles are Jericho. Some are Ai. And so sometimes, and a lot of the times, leaders have to lead through setbacks and bounce backs, as we'll call it. You're familiar with the story of Ai, and let's talk about this idea of when there is sin in the camp. Because it's just a sad truth that in every organization, every group of people, even all of us at times, people will break faith. So in chapter 7, if you would read verse 1 with me, you know the story. But the people of Israel broke faith in regard to the devoted things. For Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zebdi, the son of Zerah of the tribe of Judah, took some of the devoted things, and the anger of the Lord burned against the people of Israel. So now what do you do, leader? You've got sin in the camp, and it's about to come a very public sin. And I think you guys know the story. Achan has kept some of the things from Jericho, and we just talked about, included in that very specific instruction from God through Joshua, through his commanders, leaders, was that all of Jericho was to be devoted to the Lord. So we have a very clear violation of God's law from someone here who has broken faith. And you know how that plays out. They go up to take Ai. And it's interesting, they're so confident because of how easy Jericho was. Joshua, you don't need to send all of us up there. And so let's take a small force up there to take Ai. And you guys remember how that battle went and the first battle of Ai? Yeah, they were ended up turning their back and fleeing and having to run from the enemy. So then you get the situation that leaders have to lead through unforeseen circumstances. So pick the story up in verse 2. Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is near Beth-Aven, east of Bethel, and said to them, "Go up and spy out the land." And the men went up and spied out Ai, and they returned to Joshua and said to him, "Do not have all the people go up, but let about 2,000 or 3,000 men go up and attack Ai. Do not make the whole people toil up there, for they are few." So about 3,000 went up from the people, and they fled before the men of Ai. The men of Ai killed about 36 of their men and chased them before the gate as far as Sherebarim and struck them in the descent. And here's the impact. And the hearts of the people melted and became as water. So now you have unforeseen failure, unforeseen circumstances. You think leaders ever deal with surprises? Leadership may be most critical during unforeseeable or unforeseen circumstances. Does anybody have a, besides COVID, because we'll come back around that for some other reason, anybody have a good story about some major thing that was totally unforeseeable or unforeseen that happened that became a real leadership challenge? I mean, yes, sir. Well, you're right. If they could be contained, so that's a good point. Is there are things like this going on all the time that unless you're the one who has to deal with it, you'll never know about. But occasionally, you have things like what happens here, where it affects people beyond those involved, and these unforeseen circumstances become an unanticipated failure because now you got the whole nation has just lost in battle. They don't know what's going on, and the whole nation, their hearts have melted like water. So this is a public sin that has affected the attitude of everybody you have to lead. And you're leading the guilty and the innocent.
I can think of men who are in leadership positions in some grievous, shameful sin is exposed. You put confidence in them, you put them in roles of confidence, and the reverberations of that are massive. And there's a lot of emotions tied up with what people think should happen next, and you've got to stay, keep a calm head and take careful and measured steps going forward.
I hope none of you have had to deal with a situation like that, but when a beloved elder or a preacher is caught up in a public sin, it does cause all the people's water, hearts to melt as water. And then who's left has to lead through it. Somebody kind of described, you know, we don't have to go into details, but you've been in a situation like that, haven't you? We've talked about recently. Maybe one everybody can identify with. Have you had a very beloved church member pass away suddenly? And it affects everybody in the church. There are just times and places where you have unforeseen circumstances that leaders have to find a way to lead people through it, and that's the guilty and the innocent. But remember this as you think about what do we do next? How do we handle this? Leaders protect the name of the Lord. Read verses 6 through 9 with me. Then Joshua tore his clothes and fell to the earth on his face before the ark of the Lord until the evening, and he and the elders of Israel. And they put dust on their heads, and Joshua said, "Alas, O Lord God, why have you brought this people over the Jordan at all, to give us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us? Would that we had been content to dwell beyond the Jordan. O Lord, what can I say when Israel has the Canaanites and when Israel has turned their backs before their enemies? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear of it and will surround us and cut off our name from the earth. And what will you do for your great name?" And the point I want to make here is, it sounds you're tracking with Joshua and his immediate concerns and the fear of enemies, but ultimately by the time he finishes, what's Joshua's concern? We've been a reproach upon you. And you think about throughout the Bible, whether it's Daniel's prayer of kind of national repentance and those kind of things, that their concern is, what will happen to your city and you And that's what Josh is saying here. So leaders of God's people are concerned about protecting God's name. Because I tell you what, when leaders respond to crisis and they do it wrong, it's because they're concerned about protecting something else. It's because they're concerned about their reputation or the reputation of the person who's guilty. And again, it's the difference between simple and easy. Because unmaking some messes is not easy. But the principle that the most important thing is to protect the name of God is simple. And then it takes that strength and courage to do the things to make that the case.
Well, I think it's interesting in verse 1 that Joshua in writing said the children of Israel, that it really wasn't all the children, but all the children of Israel were penalized.
Yes. And this is very much that, you know, he's the leader of the innocent and the guilty. And we're all suffering for the consequences that they don't even know who yet. But just think about that. What is the challenge in every local church where what really is at stake is the reputation of the Lord and his church? Church discipline. All the reasons we're hesitant to do it, the reasons some have quit doing it, but what's the right thing to do? Do what the Lord said about it. To not let, you know, we'll come up again later, but there's always a reason to do it. And one is because it brings reproach upon the Lord and upon his church to have people that are unfaithful, that are walking in darkness, to be still associated with or part of that church there. So there are times when the things that you have to think about as a leader aren't who's going to be upset about this, how many people are in their family, you know, if they all leave, but it's protecting the name of the Lord, defending the name of the Lord, doing what God would have us to do.
I think sometimes we don't think that this would work because we think that the job of this is to bring the leader back. And many times it's just keep the church healed. We need to remember that.
Yeah, just the way I said is this. I think about three reasons you do church discipline. You hope the person will return, but you're also doing it to warn the simple, as I said in Romans 16, or warn the naive or the other people that are there. Your children are sitting there, and if they see that it's not a big deal if somebody is in open sin, well, discipline shows them that it is a big deal. And the third reason is to maintain the purity of the bride of Christ, right? So let me tell you this, Bob's simple math. If that brother or sister never comes back, you've still accomplished two of the three purposes, haven't you? So I would suggest to you that church discipline works every time, and it always bats at least 666. Any baseball fans in here? Can you make a living batting 600? Yeah, so listen, church discipline always accomplishes two of the three reasons that you do that. But that goes back to the idea of leaders holding people accountable. And listen, you guys know on this one, they hold everybody accountable. You know what happens next. God tells, first of all, leaders can't roll around in the trouble. Look, so you got Joshua lamenting, ripping his clothes. God lets him do that for a little while, but then look in verse 10. The Lord said to Joshua, get up. Why's Joshua got to get up? Because leaders get up and show up, right? Joshua, get up. Why have you fallen on your face? Israel has sinned. They have transgressed my covenant that I commanded them. They have taken some of the devoted things and stolen and lied and put them among their own belongings. So leaders don't have the luxury of wallowing in sorrow and self-pity. There's something that needs to be done. Yes, sir. Yes. That's right. He couldn't wallow in it. He had the contrite heart. We've sinned against God, and it goes to the core of saying, "And you know, how's this going to affect your name?" That's the contrition he shows there. But then somebody's got to stand up, and somebody's got to go about trying to be the solution. I will tell you this, and this is the case in the military. It's the case in churches. Sometimes the most important contribution a leader can make is just to be the one who remains calm when nobody else does. Sometimes people that are still on the ground They just need to look up and see somebody that stood up. And that in and of itself, the conviction to remain calm and take care of what needs to be done, is in and of itself some of the most important contributions a leader can make. And the inability to do that will keep someone from ever being an effective leader, if I can be honest with you. But the other thing we learn here, he's got to hold all these people accountable, because look at the solution set. He says, okay, here's what you're going to do, Joshua. You're going to march the whole nation by. You're going to march by tribe, and then we'll come by clan, and then smaller than clan will be by household or family, and then man by man until we figure out who's guilty. So here's a little foreshadowing in the New Testament. Who's involved in the discipline process? Everybody. Do you see that? But so he's given these instructions how to handle this. Let me suggest to you, problems remain problems until you fix them. In verse 12 and 13 describe that. God says, I will be with you no more unless you destroy the devoted things from among you. Leaders don't have the luxury to sit on a problem. Bad news does not get better with age, right? And that's just a truism. Problems have to be dealt with. And when God tells Joshua, I'm not going to be with you anymore until this is fixed, and you see that he takes care of it. And then you guys know how it ends. Go to verse 25 with me. And Joshua said, talking to Achan here, why did you bring trouble on us? The Lord brings trouble on you today. And all Israel stoned him with stones. They burned them with fire and stoned them with stones. And they raised over them a great heap of stones that remain to this day. Then the Lord turned from his burning anger. Therefore, to this day, the place is called the Valley of Achor. So, I'll have to say this. Joshua had to lead them through this discipline, through the correction of this public sin. Because Joshua is a leader of the guilty and the innocent here, but his main priority was protecting the name of the Lord. And there are lessons here, and I don't want to keep harping on it, but discipline is the lesson here. Discipline is unpleasant. But in this instance, just like today, it had to be public, and it had to be memorable. They built a monument there, you know, in order to have the effect it needed to have. And now you think about, like Romans, 16 verses 17 and 18, that kind of Paul uses the principle we've already talked about as how you mark those, mark. Something that'll be public and memorable. The idea of this person, we're identifying this person as a problem, and one of the reasons he says there you do it is protect the unknowing, or protect the naive, protect the simple. Those who don't understand why you're having to do it, this is how you teach them why you're having to do it. And that's what happens with discipline. Do you think there were people there present at the stoning of Achan that didn't learn anything? All right. So leaders have to deal with setbacks. But then the other side of that is leaders get to lead through the bounce backs. Leaders keep the faith. Look at chapter 8. We'll finish this slide, then I'll give you guys a 5-minute break. So how do you respond to a setback? Well, you got to have a plan. And that thing's what we see happens here pretty quickly. Start reading verse 1 with me in chapter 8. And notice this. As soon as they did what he told them to do at the end of the last chapter, then the Lord turned from his burning anger. Don't miss those lessons we learn about who God is. And in the midst of it, when it's not a passage about God's long-suffering or his loving kindness, his willingness to forgive, but when you actually see it happening. When you see him say, hey, until you fix this, I'll be with you no more. They fix it, and the Lord turns from his burning anger. That's who God is. Chapter 8, and the Lord said to Joshua, do not fear and do not be dismayed. Take all the fighting men with you and arise and go to Ai. See, I have given it into in your hand, the king of Ai and his people, his city and his land. And you should do to Ai and its kings as you did to Jericho and its kings. Only its spoil and its livestock you shall take as plunder for yourselves. Lay in ambush against the city and behind it. So Joshua and all the fighting men arose to go up to Ai. And do you see how quickly things turn when you have contrition, you have repentance, and you have leadership through a crisis, you have leadership through the setback, and then you're ready to start with the comeback or the bounce back. So how does he respond to this? You guys know this story as well. He's got that plan. It's the elaborate ambush up at Ai where he sends some people to hide behind the city. And then he uses their false confidence against them. He says, we'll take a smaller force and we'll get there where they can see us. I know what they're going to do. They're going to come out after us. And you know what they think we're going to do? They think we're going to take off running again. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to take off running again. And they will follow us. And they'll tell their friends, hey, they're running again. And then all the fighting men from Ai and Bethel come out and get in the chase, right? And then the other party that was laying in ambush goes into the city and takes it without firing a shot. Without firing a shot. Get it? They didn't have guns back then? Okay. Anyway, so you guys know that God did give them the city because of their faithful response and their willingness. Hey, if you'd been in that group that had gone up to Ai the first time, but you're getting right back in formation this morning. And you're showing your faith. And you're going back up there to take Ai this time and do it God's way. So they execute God's plan. And here's the lesson for leaders. Plan the work and then work the plan. So in conjunction with God, that's what you see Joshua doing here. Plan the work and then work the plan. Execute what needs to be done. Put the steps and measures in place to accomplish, according to God's guidance, what needs to be done. And lo and behold, it will work out. And then, remembering always to credit God with any success you have, here's another leadership lesson we learned from this episode. Leaders continually seek renewed commitment. So don't waste the capital of an accomplishment in your home, in your family, in your local church. You know, if you're prone to get really excited because Junior got two hits on Friday night, get more excited when he leads a song on Sunday night. Amen. You can say what you want. And I see a lot of people that rent space for messages to their children in their 12th grade album. And somewhere there it'll say, remember to keep putting God first in your life. And sometimes it strikes me how little I saw those parents put God first in their kids' life the first 11 years they were in school. But be somebody who never misses an opportunity to leverage spiritual success toward renewed commitment. Start reading in verse 30 with me of chapter 8. After the victory at Ai. At this time, Joshua built an altar to the Lord, the God of Israel, at Mount Ebal. Listen for the language that we've already seen in Joshua, the alls and do-alls, and just as Moses commanded in the law and those things. Just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded the people of Israel, as it is written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of uncut stones upon which no man has wielded an iron tool, and they offered it on burnt offerings to the Lord, sacrificed peace offerings. And there, in the presence of the people of Israel, he wrote on the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he had written. And all Israel, sojourner as well as native born, with their elders and officers and their judges, stood on opposite sides of the ark before the Levitical priest who carried the ark of the covenant of the Lord, half of them in front of Mount Gerizim, half of them in front of Mount Ebal, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded at the first to bless the people of Israel. Let me just stop there and say, notice this. By doing it just as God had told Moses to do it, he's already renewing their commitment. He's already creating in their minds and their hearts a commitment to the way God has said do this. And that's what we're going to do. Just going through the right motions with the right motivation, but going through the right motion shows regard and respect for God and His law and what Moses had written for them. And afterward, he read all the words of the law, the blessing and the curse, according to all that is written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses commanded that Joshua did not read before all the assembly of Israel and the women and the little ones and the sojourners who were among them. So all this to say that. The importance, notice who was in the crowd. And it's leaders. You know, that's what we have our assemblies for. Is we get together to help, every time we're there, help this group of people renew their commitment to the Lord. Fathers, I don't think this is a crowd where I got to harp on church attendance, but you need to talk to the young fathers in your crowds about bringing their families to services. You need to first set the example And then you need to help others see the importance of having their wives and their little ones there when you're gathered together to remember what God has done for you and to renew their commitment to the Lord. So that's an important thing. Leaders have to set the example, and leaders have to teach and demonstrate that. And Joshua did that. But I just want to just end on this one. This is really what we're doing in every way, whether it's in our home or in the local churches. The end result of leadership is only about convincing the people to seek renewed commitment to the Lord. And as a leader, it's just an opportunity to serve to help accomplish that. So always be thinking about ways to do that, suggesting ways to do that, ways to be better at doing that. And when you ever are in a formal position of leadership, remember, that's what the mission is. It's not about you. It's about those people and helping all of us renew our commitment to the Lord. Let's take a break now. Let's say 5 minutes. Y'all just start up again in 5 minutes, if that's cool. Stations ahead there in a little break. There's even more here than I'm making time to mention, and you'll notice Joshua got up just as early to take care of the unfun part as he did the fun part, because leaders have to do the discipline as much as they do the winning battles. It wasn't just Achan who got stoned, and it's his whole household, right? So you talk about that ownership of household. There's a demonstration for you there, and that cuts both ways. But a lot of good lessons, a lot of things to think about there. And Joshua spending the night with the people. We're specifically told, and that night Joshua slept in the field with the people. So that's that leader in the trenches taking care of what the people were trying to take care of. Next thing I want to talk about is how leaders have to deal with deception and distraction. So over in chapter 9, if you would, again, a story we're mostly familiar with, but we're going to cut it from the leadership perspective. And what I suggest to you is the story of the Gibeonites proves that leaders have to be on guard against deception. And also all the kings, begin reading verse 1 of chapter 9 with me. As soon as all the kings who were beyond the Jordan in the hill country and in the lowland across all the coast of the great sea toward Lebanon, the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, and Hivites, and the Jebusites heard this, they gathered together as one to fight against Joshua and Israel. But the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, and they on their part acted with cunning and went out and made provisions and took worn-out sacks and their donkeys and their wineskins and their worn-out, torn, and mended. And I'll just pause there. You guys all know the story. So their decision, instead of joining this coalition to fight Joshua, was let's make him think we're from far away. We're not one of the local kingdoms he's going to have to deal with. And what we were, when we stopped reading there, what we were describing was the efforts they made to make that story believable. They put on their old clothes, loaded up with worn-out equipment and stale bread in order to make it look like they were from other places. And what I want to suggest to you here, when you put on your leadership hat, again, whether in your home or in the church, most dangerous error seems plausible. Right? Because if it's obviously untrue, it wouldn't be that dangerous. So dangerous error looks or sounds a little bit like the truth, or enough like the truth that people will listen to it, or enough like the truth that it will fool some people. And that's just a principle we have to be prepared for. Think about this story. The Gibeonites looked the part. They looked like a people from far away. They looked like a people who had been on a long journey. So most error contains some truth. And that's the same way it is with false doctrine and false teaching. Nobody has any success walking into our church and saying, hey, I'm going to tell you guys something that's not true. And nobody has a jersey that says, number one, false teacher on the back. So you have to be on guard against deception and distraction. And you see Joshua and his first echelon of leaders kind of drop the ball here. Listen, the most dangerous false teachers among us look the part. They appear to be very spiritual. They appear to be very engaged. They appear to be very sincere. And they may be all those things. But the litmus test is what they're teaching according to what God has revealed. That's always the litmus test. That's always for Joshua. It's all that was written in the law. And his marching orders were don't go to the left or to the right, but do all that the Lord has commanded. So always be on guard against deception. It's not easy to detect, maybe, but we have the standard. The danger is that sometimes things that might deceive us are attractive, right? That's why it's dangerous. That's why it's deceptive. Sometimes there's teaching that it seems more loving than the truth. Sometimes there's teaching that therefore is more attractive than the truth because it appears to be more loving to people. But here's the secret you guys already know. Knowledge of His will is our safeguard. Very quickly, turn over to Colossians chapter 1, if you would. This is just a passage I think is very telling when you see what Paul wants for the Colossians. And it aligns with what we're talking about here. Listen, Colossians chapter 1, verse 9. "And so from the day we heard, we have not ceased to pray for you, asking that you may be filled with blank." Who's old enough to remember the match game? Game show? Great, just me and guys older than me. All right. But if you played the match game with people in most churches, and you have Paul saying, "Hey, I'm praying that you be filled with," what do you think the top three numbers, top three answers would be?
Love,
spirit, peace, joy. Not anything wrong with any of those. But just notice here that you all be filled with the knowledge of His will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding, so as to walk in a manner worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing to Him, bearing fruit in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God. So just be reminded, our safeguard is knowledge of His will. And what Paul reminds the Colossians here, the way he phrases this, is that knowledge of His will is a safeguard against unrevealed ideas. So if we know what He said, we know if what we're hearing is part of what He said or not. All spiritual wisdom is a safeguard against human wisdom. If it doesn't originate from God, it originates from man. All spiritual understanding will guide the Christian in their decision making. And that's important because almost as important as the therefores and the wherefores in Paul's writing is the so that's. Because there's a reason for what he just said. And it's so that you will know how to walk in a manner worthy of the Lord, so that you will know what is fully pleasing to Him, and so that you will bear fruit in every good work. And then I love how he closes a loop here, as and grow in the knowledge of the Lord. And there he's talking about that experiential knowledge that you gain by doing the Lord's will. You see, it's a full circle from knowledge to more knowledge to more knowledge. But the safeguard against error is knowledge of His will. And that's important. And a lesson we learned back in our Joshua context is leaders must test the spirits. Right? You guys all know that if you read in 1 John chapter 4 and verse 1, that's exactly what John says to those Christians who are dealing with doctrine that is not what the apostles taught. But look here back in our context in Joshua chapter 9 now. Missed opportunities to do that. Chapter 9 and verse 8. "Then they said to Joshua, 'We are your servants.' And Joshua said to them, 'Who are you and where do you come from?' So Joshua inquired a little bit, but he didn't get down to ground truth, did he? And in verse 14, "So the men took some of the provisions, but did not ask counsel from the Lord." And that's what I want you to think about. They did some inquiry, but they didn't take it to the Lord. And so I think there's a leadership lesson for us. Test the spirits. Take it to the Lord. Compare what you're hearing, what you're seeing to what has been revealed to us. That was their mistake here. They did not take it to the Lord. But another leadership lesson for us here, and we might as well admit it, leaders will make mistakes. Right? Because I don't see anybody in this room that's not human. Well, I shouldn't say anyway. Leaders will make mistakes. That's part of it. Joshua makes a mistake here. Anybody familiar with the Bible character named David? So leaders will make mistakes, right? And we have to understand that it's all about how you respond to them. Their mistake here was not seeking counsel from the Lord. So leaders will make mistakes. How you handle it is how the leaders here handled it. They made this covenant. They were determined to go ahead and honor the covenant, but it wasn't without some punishment for these people who had deceived them. You can read the details. But the lessons that emerge are this. Listen, leaders, when you make a mistake, you do what you'd expect your followers to do. Leaders, admit it, and then do what you can to mitigate the damage, right? That's what a good leader does. That's what you'll do in your home. Listen, if you haven't had a conversation yet where you set the kids down and started with an apology, hey, listen, I made a bad decision. I shouldn't have let you go there, but I'm going to do better going forward. If you haven't had a, mom and dad are sorry, we haven't been attending the monthly singing. We've decided that's a missed opportunity we've had to have you guys there with the local church, so we're going to do better going forward. I want you to know I hadn't do as well as I could by you, but I'm going to do better. So you get, as a father, as a husband, as a leader of any kind, when you see you could have done better, admit it, then mitigate the damage. That's what they do here, and then learn from it. And this kind of circles back to something I've already said. Learn the lessons. Learn what works. Learn what doesn't work. Learn from your successes and learn from your failures so that you don't repeat them. The only thing worse than a mistake is making it twice, right? I mean, go back to my point about the debrief. You've already paid the price for the mistake. At least get the value out of it. At least think about, hey, how could we have done better? I will tell you this. That's one of the things I appreciate about the group of men I serve with is that after any evolution, we talk about, hey, what worked, what didn't work? How could we have done that better? How do we want to approach that next time? So moms and dads, listen. Marlene and I always agreed we were going to stand our ground on anything we told our kids, that as far as discipline or things like that, we're going to win every argument with them. And then later, if we decided we had chosen bad ground, we just choose better ground the next time. So there's always a time when you can do better next time. And all I'm suggesting is that real leaders do that. They don't think they're perfect. They don't think they're above mistakes. And they're going to make them, but they strive to learn from them. And the final thing I want to talk about here just in a few minutes is turn over to chapter 17. Because chapter 17, you know the story as it unfolds. Next few chapters in Joshua are interesting. I would do a breakout on Caleb leadership if we had more time. But it's mostly about the land being divided up. You get the story of the conquest, the land divided up between the tribes. They're called together here, and we get to chapter 17. The tribes have been given their allotment. But there's a difference between inheriting and possessing, right? So the tribes have to go in and finish out cleaning out the inhabitants of the land. And that wasn't easy. And so you have the people coming to Joshua with a problem. But the lesson we learn from this is that leaders challenge people. And leaders challenge people by turning problems into opportunities. So in chapter 17, read verses 14 through 18 with me, then we'll be done. Then the people of Joseph spoke to Joshua, saying, "Why have you given me but one lot and one portion as an inheritance, although I am a numerous people, since all along the Lord has blessed me?" And Joshua said to them, "If you are a numerous people, go up by yourselves to the forest, and there clear ground for yourselves in the land of the Perizzites and the Rephaim, since the hill country of Ephraim is too narrow for you." The people of Joseph said, "The hill country is not big enough for us, yet all the Canaanites who dwell in the plain have chariots of iron, both those in Beth Shean and its villages and those in the valley of Jezreel." Then Joshua said to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, "You are a numerous people and have great power. You shall not have one allotment only, but the hill country shall be yours. For though it is a forest, you shall clear it and possess it to its farthest borders, for you shall drive out the Canaanites, though they have chariots of iron, and though they are strong." Then just some points to be made here. There's the clear observations about the times. You wonder how many times having God on your side works out, that it's going to take them to learn the lesson. That's how that'll go. If you'll do God's will, it'll work out for you. But don't chuckle too much, because this room is full of people who from time to time forget that if I'll do what God said, things will work out for me, right? So does not be too hard on the Israelites. But here for our leadership lessons from this, here's what we see from Joshua. You turn problems into opportunities. One of the things we teach junior officers right away is, hey, listen, don't come to me with a problem if you don't have a proposed solution. If you come to me with a problem without a proposed solution, you're really just complaining. I don't have time for complainers. But come to me with a problem and a proposed solution, and we'll talk about it, and we'll get busy trying to fix it. And that's really, that is informal training for tomorrow's leaders. So when a young guy in a congregation asked me, hey, do you think we could have, well, I don't know, how do you, I tell you what, you talk to a couple guys and get back to me and let me know how you think that would work better. those kind of things. You're giving leadership training on the fly to people when you challenge them to turn problems into opportunities. Hey, what do you have? You don't like how we're doing it. Do you have a suggestion? Those things turn problems into opportunities. Here's what you have to do is sometimes you have to encourage people to stretch themselves. What's their initial problem? Hey, there's too many of us to fit in this land. Well, then Joshua turns around. Hey, you said there's a bunch of you. Go take some more land. You know, so he turned exactly what they said on them, but he encouraged them to stretch themselves. Hey, you can do it. You go take that land. Think how many times as a leader, you need to encourage somebody to stretch themselves. Best song leader you have in your church led his first song sometime. First Bible class, the best Bible class leader in your congregation, there's a time when he hadn't taught Bible class yet. That young lady, he's only been married for a little while and hasn't had anybody over to her house yet. She has to learn how to be hospitable sometime. So there's all these opportunities, these little things that you encourage people to do for the first time to encourage them to stretch themselves that are important. But in this instance, what you see is that leaders provide vision. And this is where we'll end on today. And you guys just had a five-minute break a while ago, so I don't mind only giving you a six-minute one now before Marshall starts. Leaders provide vision. That's what we've been talking about. That from Bob's definitions, managers can execute a schedule. Leaders provide vision. And here's what I'm saying, man, and we'll end here. Look, everybody can see the iron chariots, right? You think about it, you're one of those people in this room. Everybody sees the iron chariots, but not everyone can envision a land without them. And so that's what a leader helps do. Helps people see beyond what's right here, beyond what they can do today to what they can do in the future. How to grow into being a place of a better service and a better servant. Everybody can see the problems, the obstacles, the barriers, or why an idea won't work. Not everyone has vision, and leaders help them with that. Leaders help with vision, help with communicating it, and then help inspire it. And the lesson here is one that applies today. Listen, some people just need a little nudge to do what they already can do. But sometimes being a leader is just that little nudge. And there's probably, every one of you here can think of one time and place in your life where somebody said, hey, you can do that, and convinced you to do that one thing you thought you could never do. And now you can regularly execute that sort of thing. So just remember that. Leadership sometimes happens very quietly and off to the side, and it's just providing people that little extra incentive to do what they know they need to do. So that's daring to fight battles. Remember, not every battle is going to be Jericho. And we have to be prepared to lead people to the first battle of AI, recover from it, and go fight the second battle of AI. Leaders always have to be ready to fight the next battle. Thank you for your attention.